Hello everyone, Stan Gill here. Welcome to the Hollywood South Blacklist. This is show number 7 and was originally recorded on Friday, October 19th, 2012. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, send us an email to podcast@thehollywoodsouthblog.com. And be sure to stop by the website to take a look around. Enjoy. Well, hello everybody, Stan Gill here, and this is the Hollywood South Blacklist, where we discuss all things Hollywood South, a filmmaker's paradise. On this show, we'll have some listener email, we'll talk about the indie film scene in Hollywood South, we'll pick up where we left off about crowdfunding, comparison of crowdfunding websites from previous podcasts, the crowdfunding updates under the Jobs Act, and collaboration on scripts between the parties involved, how the contract works out. And we'll discuss a little bit about the NOLA Film Festival, the NOLA Bound doc that premiered at the Joy Theater recently, and how you can watch it online. I'll have my book recommendation and my software recommendation. Chris B. writes, "How do I find out about getting on films? I want to change career aspirations, and I don't know where to start." Well, that's a good question. A lot of people ask that. People who don't work in the industry, who've had a taste of, say, working on a set, want to eventually try to see if they can find a position in the film and television industry and see if they like it, or they want to change careers, like Chris is talking about. There's three rules to getting in this industry. Rule number one, network. Rule number two, network. And rule number three, network. Yes, that's it. Three things you need to know. That's really what this comes down to. This industry is not like your conventional business where, let's say, for instance, you want to be an accountant or you're a lawyer, that there's job board sites that you can go to, or companies or law firms or accounting firms that you can go to their websites and see if they have openings and work their way up through those corporations or those companies. The film and television industry is classified as seasonal employment by the U.S. Department of Labor. So with that respect, a lot of people work as independent contractors. However, there are technicalities where crew members are hired on shows and they're considered employees specific to that production. And I don't want to get too deep into the swamp on those technicalities for this podcast. But to answer Chris's question, first thing to do is go to thehollywoodsouthblog.com. You can get free crew listings there. So let's say, for instance, you want to be a grip, or you're a gaffer, or you're an electrician and you want to do more construction work, or vice versa, or you're a camera assistant, or you've come out of film school and you'd like to be a camera assistant. Fill out a crew listing ad there. And guess what? It's free. You can fill out as many as you want and get posted up onto the website. So when people are looking for crews, I get a lot of inquiries that come across the website looking for crew members for certain projects that, you know, film, television shows. The other thing is that the state, which you can find links on the website also, has a monthly, if you will, production report that they send out for shows that are in production that are coming up. And there's a lot of email addresses and fax numbers that you can send in your resumes, and you can email your resumes in for those productions. Don't worry if you can't find it. It's published all on the HollywoodSouthBlog.com in the production hotline updates, that you can go there. You can even go back in time and look at the previous shows that were there. And as time goes on, you'll start networking and start developing a network of people that you work with. For instance, let's say you are a carpenter and you build houses, or you're a framer and you work on building houses, but you like working in the film industry because a buddy of yours or somebody you know said, hey, they needed somebody to come along and help build some sets out on a location or on a stage, and you helped out for a couple of days. Hence the term day player. And you said, wow, I like this. This is much better than building houses. You want to get involved in that. Go to the website, fill out some crew listing, free crew listing ads. It's very easy to fill out, and your network. You want to network with those people. And as time goes on, you'll find yourself working on more and more projects. Maybe you no longer want to be a carpenter. All of a sudden, you start liking working on, you know, what's being done in G&E, grip and electrical crew, the crew that actually humps to make the film work when it comes to the lighting on the set and the grip and the mounting devices for the cameras and the dollies and the cranes and things like that. Maybe you're interested in that. Chris, what I'm trying to say is that you've got to network. This is not like a normal business, if you will, like I said before, where you could go to a company's website, get on their careers job list, and start applying for jobs. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't find a position at, say, a production company, if you will, who's advertising. But that's generally speaking more in New York and in Hollywood, in Los Angeles, where you find hundreds of companies in the studios advertising hundreds and thousands of jobs that you can apply to. That's different. Hollywood South does not have that infrastructure up yet. Most of the companies there, the little boutique post-production houses, vendors that supply services or rental services to the film and television industry, every once in a while they may have an opening and they need a driver or they need help on the floor to start packaging, say, lighting and grip rentals. Or say it's a truck rental company and they need someone to help prepare the trucks, wash the trucks, get them gassed up, get the tires checked, things like that. So the number one thing, like I said in the beginning, is you've got to network. There's really no magic potion to it. You may get on a show, you may get on a crew where, say, going back to my example of being a framer, you're a framer, you build houses, but you got a taste of working in film, building sets, you hook up with a crew, and as time goes on, you're able to jump from project to project. Those are things that happen in this industry. Same thing with hair and makeup, wardrobe, production design, assistant cameras, the camera crew, things like that. So I hope that answered your question. Next listener email is Stella M. writes, would like to hear more about acting in Hollywood South. Now that's a good question. As Hollywood South has grown over the last, say, 10 years, I've noticed more and more background acting casting companies pop up. In fact, I'm starting to see them pop up like mushrooms left and right. Now, I don't want to distract, and I don't want to denigrate anybody who's a casting director who cast background actors. But there's a lot of competition out there, and some are just organizers. They just organize a massive quantity of people and get them on the set and try to get their paperwork done and get paid by the production companies. However, there are a lot of very professional companies that take their jobs seriously because they want to be in business. They want to go from project to project. They want to get those screen credits and they want to provide a good service to the productions coming in town. I've thought about this for a long time about the acting aspect when it comes to Hollywood South. As I found is that when you go to, you know, going back to Chris B's question, when you go to these networking events, you're going to network with one of two types of people. You'll be networking, say you'll go to an event, you'll be networking with actors. And all they care about is getting in front of the camera, becoming a background actor, and working their way up, taking classes, becoming better at their craft, maybe they just want to do it as a part-time gig, or they want to change careers, or that is their career. There's nothing wrong with that. Or you'll go to an event, which is generally smaller, where it'll be crew-oriented, where you'll run into grips, electricians, camera assistants, wardrobe stylists, hair, makeup people, things like that. To boil it down, you'll run into actors and crew. I thought about putting the, you know, acting aspect into the Hollywood South Blacklist podcast, this podcast. I figured that what would happen is that I'm aiming for two audiences, an acting audience or a crew audience. And I'm not saying that I'm choosing one over the other. There are things that actors can learn from this podcast that would help them in their career. I don't want to tread on other people's ground, if you will, the acting instructors, the people that have much more acting skills than I do, for sure. That's the reason why I work behind the camera and not in front of the camera. And at the same time, your time would be better spent, say, listening to this podcast from a crew standpoint And if you're an actor listening to it, because you'll pick up on things. Because if you're doing a small project and let's say you're going to act in it, but you're going to write it and you're going to try to produce it, but you don't know how to shoot with a camera, but you've got a friend or somebody who's willing to shoot it for you, things like that, all of a sudden now you're using acting skills and you're using producing skills and crew skills. So in short, Stella, I don't want actors to turn away from the podcast, and I don't want you to turn away from the podcast. You'll at least learn something that you can translate into your career or into your hobby if this is a hobby for you. Let's see. Jeff J. writes, I don't have a fancy phone and want to hear the podcast. A friend told me about it. How can I get the podcast? Very easy. Once the podcast is published and it goes out on iTunes, it's also published up on the website, thehollywoodsouthblog.com, and you can download it directly from there. If you don't want to sync up with iTunes or you don't have an iTunes account and don't want to hassle that and you just want to download it directly to your computer or your listening device, your MP3 player, then you can download it directly from their website. So there you go, Jeff. Boy, I tell you, after the last few podcasts where I talked about crowdfunding and my opinions on it, I got a lot of emails saying, hey, well, we were thinking about doing a Kickstarter campaign or an Indiegogo campaign, and now you're saying don't do that. Well, I never specifically said don't do that. I said specifically to do it so that you would get that experience. I don't necessarily see them as avenues for getting your projects produced, where I, at the same time, I won't deny that there are projects out there, say documentaries or short films, that do get funded, that make $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 and get some money enough for people to get their projects funded. In fact, I had a friend the other day, and if I can remember their campaign correctly, I think they got somewhere around $5,000 or $6,000 or got over their limit on either Kickstarter or Indiegogo, and now they have enough funds that they can put together a trailer, a proof of concept. And if you recall in the previous podcast, when I talk about proof of concept in the business world, that's the term they use. In the quote unquote Hollywood world, everybody talks about a trailer or a promo or a teaser. I picked up an article back in the November 2011 issue of Inc. magazine called Comparison of Crowdfunding Websites. And don't worry if you're in the car or jogging or working out or something like that, and you're listening to this, I'll have the links to all the articles and everything I discuss on the podcast on the show notes after the podcast is posted, so don't worry about that. This article, Comparison of Crowdfunding Websites, starts off by saying, quote, artists, filmmakers, and musicians flock to sites like Kickstarter, like I talked before, to raise cash for their projects. Now entrepreneurs are getting into the game, hence the proof of concept I was talking about. There are dozens of crowdfunding sites, including some geared specifically to startups. It's not just money that users are after. A successful campaign can also generate buzz and provide proof of concept to professional investors. And there's that term, proof of concept. And if you're in the business world, that's a term that is used a lot. Film and television world, think promo, teaser, trailer, things like that. Quote, but raising small sums from hundreds of strangers is hard work. Your pitch must be concise and compelling. And because crowdfunding happens online, it helps to be a whiz at using Facebook, Twitter, and other social sites to spread the word about your project, unquote. And this is where I got into in the previous podcast that you put up a Kickstarter campaign, an Indiegogo campaign, and you just spam the crap out of your friends and family on their Twitter pages and their Facebook pages and all the other social media websites, just beating them into the ground. In fact, some of them probably donate to your campaign just because they want you to go away, and they're not, they want to be polite, and they don't want to turn around and tell you, you know, stop hassling me. In all reality, sometimes that's what it turns out to be, where you do not see the big picture of it, you're just focused on your project. So there's a pitfall that you can fall into, that you can actually alienate friends, alienate family, who knows. So be careful when you use these. This article talks about these websites, and I'm going to break them down for you. Let's first start off with Kickstarter. That seems to be a popular one. What is it? Kickstarter is a platform for entrepreneurs to finance innovative new projects. However, The site also allows filmmakers to do the same thing. Let's say you're creating a new iPhone widget that goes on the iPhone and you're trying to generate funds and raise cash so that you can build a proof of concept and actually get it into production. And for 10 bucks, you can get a copy of that widget, one of those widgets, and then when it goes into production, they sell it for 30 bucks or something to that effect. I've seen a lot of those campaigns. I've seen a lot of them do very well. The site has seen more than 13,000 successful campaigns since its launch in 2009. Doing the numbers, if you look at it, they talk about successful campaigns. Now, the thing about Kickstarter is this is how it works. Each project on Kickstarter gets a fundraising page. Think of it as a Facebook page, but it's open more to the world, if you will. You can do the same with Facebook, but in this instance on Kickstarter, has other tools involved to allow donations, which includes the funding goal, a video explaining the venture, and the deadline 1 to 60 days after launch. 1 to 60 days after launch. Campaigns are expected to offer rewards to contributors. Such perks run the gamut from a thank you on the company website to a prototype like I was talking about before. You get the prototype for, say, 10 bucks as opposed to what retail or street value would be, say, 30. If you don't hit your goal by the deadline, you won't see a penny. If you set your Kickstarter campaign and you're trying to raise money for a trailer for a feature you want to produce, and you want to shoot this trailer in hopes to try to, you know, gather investors to invest in the feature. And let's say, for instance, you set your goal at $10,000. On Kickstarter, you raise $9,000, you have 24 hours to go. If you don't make that $10,000, you don't get to see any of those $9,000. It just disappears. Here's the catch. Kickstarter accepts about 60% of the 2,000 or so projects that apply each week. 2,000 projects apply each week, and they only accept 60%. Generally speaking, the way I found, if you're doing a project, a film project, and you want to raise money, and I'm going to this proof of concept theory, where you want to produce this trailer, this teaser for your project, there's a good possibility, in my opinion, and I don't have any stats or numbers to back this up, but I'm going to guess you got a high probability of getting that thing accepted, because what do they care? They only make money if you make money. So if you get your funding goal, going back to the example, $10,000, and you make that $10,000, then they're going to get at Kickstarter, 5% of the funds raised on Kickstarter, plus there's about 3% to 5% to Amazon Payments, which handles all the payment processing. So you're talking about anywhere from 8 to 10%. If you, believe it or not, you want to raise $10,000, all of a sudden you meet your funding goal and you're jumping up and down, hey, we met it. Next thing you know, you're getting $9,000. And like, whoa, what happened? You're only going to get $9,000 because Kickstarter is going to take their VIG and Amazon Payments is going to take theirs for processing the payment. Personally, I think it's way too much. Kickstarter says the average raised on their website is $5,000. The next crowdfunding website is Indiegogo, which a lot of people have heard, just like Kickstarter. Generally speaking, the filmmaker community has heard of Kickstarter and Indiegogo. Indiegogo was founded in 2008, and it sort of takes an anything-goes approach. This is how it works. Each project gets a profile page, just like Kickstarter, with a video, a written summary, descriptions of perks for funders, a fundraising goal, and a deadline 1 to 120 days from the launch date, which is about double what Kickstarter had. The thing is that you basically have control over everything. You can write whatever you want. You can post a video up there. It comes down to your marketing skills, your pitch, if you will, for the people that go to that page and see that. Now, businesses can keep whatever they raise, whether the goal is $100 or whether it's $100,000. Indiegogo has a slightly different fee structure, or VIG, if you will. They take 4% if your fundraising goal is met. So if your fundraising goal was $10,000, they're going to take 4% of that. If it's not met, they'll take 9%. Now, there's a third-party payment processing of 2.9%, so you do the numbers between Kickstarter and Indiegogo. The thing is, in Kickstarter, if you don't make your goal, you don't get one red cent. However, on Indiegogo, if you do make your goal, you get that minus the fee for Indiegogo and also the payment processing fee. However, if you don't make your fundraising goal, the fee is 5% lower. The average raise on Indiegogo is around $15,000. In this article, you'll also find ProFounder and MicroVentures that are listed. Now, those generally are crowdfunding sites that are geared towards business and technology and products and things like that, as opposed to filmmaking. So generally speaking, you're looking at Kickstarter or Indiegogo. And I get this question all the time: should I do a Kickstarter campaign or should I do an Indiegogo campaign? And the first thing that tells me is the person asking me that question never did their homework. The thing is that you should either do both or do none at all. You think to yourself, well, then I should do one on Kickstarter and I should do one on Indiegogo, maybe, or do one just on Kickstarter or just one on Indiegogo. It's up to you to determine. You have to make these business decisions. It's not as simple as just saying, I'm going to throw up my teaser trailer that I've shot, that I've spent 6 months working on, and put it on their website and turn around, and in 30 days it's going to be completely funded because people are just going to go there and they're going to love my idea and they're going to buy the DVD when it comes out or whatever your perks happen to be. What I'm saying is that you need to go to the websites, go through their FAQs, go through their steps, if you will, in setting up a project. If I recall correctly, on Indiegogo, I can't remember on Kickstarter, but on Indiegogo, you can actually build an entire campaign and put it together, but not publish it. So there's sort of a switch, if you will, if they haven't changed it in, I don't know, the last year. There's a switch, if you will, where you set up your campaign and then you flip a switch to make it go live, then the clock starts. You can't stop it until the clock has expired. If you want to set up a campaign and all of a sudden things change or something about your project is moving on, if you will, let's say you start on it and then next thing you know it just falls apart, you can still put the campaign together and decide whether you want to launch it or not. Those are the kinds of things that you can do on Indiegogo. Kickstarter has their own program and their own way of putting it together. However, generally, between the two of them, except for the goal and the payouts and the fee structure, they're about the same. Think of Kickstarter as you got to make your goal to get anything. Indiegogo, anything that you make, you can keep, and the fee structure is different accordingly. Take a look at both of those websites. In my opinion, overall, like I was saying in the other podcast, if you're going to go through this time and effort to set up a campaign, whether it's Kickstarter or Indiegogo, let's go back to the $10,000 example that I had before. And I don't know, I just pulled $10,000 out of the air. I don't know if you're doing a trailer or promo or whatever you happen to put together for your project, but let's say it's $10,000. And then you turn around, you put this website together. I keep saying put the website together. I mean, put your campaign together is the word that they use. You go to their site, put the campaign together before you launch it, and you've got it all, you know, with all the interviews from people. And you can, there's a mini little blog that you can add to it also, and blog as the days go by. You can add still photos. Let's say you have a one sheet of your project. When you're putting those things together, here's the question that I have. Using the example of $10,000 for your campaign, then you put it up. I'm just going to pick Indiegogo, okay? So you put your campaign up on Indiegogo and you set the clock to 120 days, which is the max. And as soon as you set it up there, you start spamming your friends on Facebook every single day and then Twitter every single day. And you just hit them and pound them and pound them and pound them. So they'll make a $10, $25 donation, $100 donation, $1,000 donation, $5,000, whatever the levels that you set. And you get to set those levels. They're called perks. That's the term that they use on the website. And let's say, for instance, that the only people that donate to your project are family and friends, because that's the first people you're going to go to, right? You're not going to go to strangers. Now, granted, there are people who troll the sites and they see something. They go, oh, wow, I'd like to have something like this. However, generally, I see those kinds of people are the ones that want a product. Going back to, say, the iPhone widget, somebody made a widget for iPhone. They, you know what? I'll donate 10 bucks, and if it never comes about and the company never gets it made, then I lost 10 bucks. But if they do, I get this $30 widget for 10 bucks, and I get this cool thing for my phone. And some people do that. When it comes to your campaign for your trailer or your promo, and using the example of $10,000, you turn around to your family and friends and you want to get donations from them, and they go to the website and they put their money into the kitty and it sits there and the money doesn't come out until your campaign is over, until the 120 days is up, if I remember correctly. I don't think they pay out before then on Indiegogo because they have to wait to see if you make your goal or not. So whether you made your $10,000 or not. And then Indiegogo is going to take their VIG of, let's say, 4%, their fee. I keep saying VIG, like I'm with the mafia. They're going to take their 4%, which is their fee. Let's say you make the goal. And then you're going to pay, I don't remember, it's like 2.5 percentage points for the automation, the automatic payments that you're going to get, because they're going to use the website to handle the transactions, the behind-the-scenes stuff, to get the money out of their business account, off of their personal account through their credit card or whatever it happens to be. Then you get that money and it's deposited in, you know, electronically into your account. Great. But here's the problem. This is my look. And like I said in the previous podcast, this is not my argument for you to not do an Indiegogo campaign and not do a Kickstarter campaign. If that's what you want to do, do it, because you're not going to get the experience unless you did it. I didn't get the experience without me doing it and without me interviewing my friends who have had success, and 9 out of 10 of them never had success. They never met their goals, and a couple of those people were shattered, and man, it was bad, because I went into it thinking, okay, if I meet it, great, I'm going to be a happy camper. If I don't, okay, I'll try something else. But I've had a couple of friends that have put together Kickstarter campaigns and Indiegogo campaigns for whatever, you know, their web series, their trailer for the feature they want to produce, and they never made their goal, and they're absolutely shattered. Like, the world just says, you suck. That was something I learned from experiencing through their campaign that I would have never experienced through my campaign. I guess I'm beating a dead horse. I'm not telling you do not do a Kickstarter campaign or do not do an Indiegogo campaign. But if your goal is to raise that money and you're going to go to your family and friends to raise the money, here's the problem. You've basically said, I want you to help finance this trailer, this promo, in hopes that we can get financing to show some executive producers, some investors to do the entire feature or series or whatever it happens to be. And then once you donate to that, somebody else is going to get a little piece of the pie. And I'm saying, cut them out completely. Cut Indiegogo out, cut Kickstarter out, okay? Now, here's the thing. There are some SEC rules that you have to be very aware of, because you essentially are going to be selling securities, and the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, will get very unhappy if you do this the wrong way. Now, did I completely confuse you? Of course I did. Let's move on to the next topic. Now, I'm going to completely confuse you by talking about SEC regulations and the Jobs Act. And I'm not doing this to confuse you. I'm just giving you an idea, and you'd be better off when you go to the website and download the show notes, taking a look at this. This is the new model, if you will, the proposed model because of the Jobs Act, the Jumpstart Our Business Startups Act, that was signed into law by President Obama. This will give you an idea of where this whole crowdfunding movement is heading. Now, I took this article from Mark Graffagnini from Graffagnini and Associates, and I hope I'm not mispronouncing his name. My apologies. He wrote an article on these new SEC rules, or the proposed rules, and the Jobs Act. Quote, on August 29, 2012, the SEC released its first set of rules clarifying what companies can do regarding crowdfunding, crowdsourcing. Under the proposed rules, which are mandated by the Jumpstart Our Business Startups Jobs Act, companies would be permitted to use general solicitation and general advertising to offer securities under the securities rule. Well, what does that mean, Stan? Well, I'm glad you asked, Stan. This is what it means. A company raising angel or venture capital, okay, you're raising money for your project, your trailer promo, cannot raise money by means of a general solicitation or general advertising campaign. Now, that's the way it stands now because, listen, you will go on Craigslist and all these other websites, or even I see it on people's web pages saying, hey, do you want to invest in my film? Contact me, hit me up, and you can invest in my film or project or whatever it is. You're essentially breaking the law right there. You're selling securities, and people are doing it. It's just a matter of time until they get caught. Like I said in a couple of podcasts ago, there were two people who got busted doing just that. I think they raised something like $30 million, and they eventually got busted by the SEC and by the state of California for trying to do this scam, if you will, and selling securities. Under current law, you cannot send an email blast out or Facebook or tweet to potential investors or post a Facebook status update offering to sell to the general public. That's the way the law is, if you will. There's a technicality here. Other examples include posting ads on unrestricted websites, Craigslist. Yes, that would include yours if it's accessible by anyone, your website. So you create a WordPress website or a website that you've put up and you start, click on this link and you can get, and if you sign this NDA, this non-disclosure agreement, then you can become an investor in our film and we'll determine whether you can be an investor in our film depending on how big your pocketbook is and your checkbook and if you're serious. Oh, and it always says serious inquiries only and it always has 3 exclamation points and it's in capitals and sometimes it's bold and sometimes it's underlined. So that's the way the law is, if you will. I probably have lost 90% of you already. And you're thinking, oh man, I just want to get my trailer done. And, what is all this securities and SEC? Don't worry, I'll help you out here. Under the proposed rules, companies may use general advertisements and general solicitations to seek investment. But there are certain conditions. These conditions are as follows. It's getting better. The issuer, you, Mr. Filmmaker, Ms. Filmmaker, must take reasonable steps to verify that investors are accredited investors. Okay, well, what's reasonable steps and what's accredited investors? And I don't have a lawyer and it's going to cost me $5,000 for a lawyer to figure this all out. Kickstarter and Indiegogo solve that problem, supposedly. The next condition is all investors actually are accredited investors, either because they come within one of the enumerated, quote-unquote, categories of persons that qualify as accredited investors, or the issuer reasonably believes that they do at the time of the sale of the securities. You know, Aunt May took out a second mortgage on her house, and you think Aunt May is very brilliant. She's very smart because she just sees that your film is going to win lots of festival awards, and so she's putting her money on the line. So she must be an accredited investor, and you've taken reasonable beliefs and steps that she is because, hey, she's Aunt May, right? And the other one is certain other standard securities rules are met. I've probably lost 99% of you. Here's the deal. When it comes to this new Jobs Act and this new idea around crowdsourcing and crowdfunding, Kickstarter and Indiegogo kicked up, and I don't want to get into the legalese of it because, one, I'm not a lawyer, even though I did go to law school. I never wanted to become an attorney. I just wanted to be a better producer. The gist of it is that here's a new way of crowdfunding your projects. Let's look at this from a filmmaker's perspective. You want to get your project produced, or you want to produce a proof of concept, a trailer, a teaser, or a promo. And the deal is that as time has moved on, and especially with the way the economy is for the past few years, they're trying to get jobs going and get things jump-started. Here is one of the ideas with this Jobs Jumpstart Our Business Startups Act is trying to solve this problem. The thing is, it's providing better rules and a better cloak of security. And what I mean by security for filmmakers are trying to get things done. Now, a couple podcasts ago, I talked about David Fincher putting together a $400,000 Kickstarter campaign to try to get a film or a teaser trailer proof of concept made for a comic book called The Goon. He wants $400,000. Well, with his name on it, that should be a lot of money. Now, just think about that. If they're going to take 9 to 10% of that, that's about 40 grand. They're going to make a lot of money. My opinion, even though I don't have any facts to back this up, but my opinion is that he's going to pay a little bit less than that, because with his name attached to Kickstarter and pushing the campaign, there's a lot of goodwill and promotion, if you will, that will help them out. And the thing is, you're not going to be able to put up a campaign for $400,000. You're looking for $10,000, $5,000. You're just trying to get by. You just want to be able to take your idea and your project and put it together. Well, with the Jobs Act being signed into law, it looks like what we're moving towards is that filmmakers are going to have an opportunity to not only just do the smaller projects, but let's say, for instance, your campaign is successful and you get your funding off of Kickstarter, or it's not successful and maybe you get 80% of your money off of Indiegogo. Now you've made your trailer and you've put up a website and you're trying to get people to invest in your film. The way the SEC is moving and the way the law is pushing them is that now all of a sudden you may be able to put together a campaign to raise $1 million, $750,000, or whatever it happens to be, to produce your project, and people from all over the globe can buy in and become a stakeholder or get a perk off of your project. It's going to take time to figure this out. It's not going to happen overnight. However, there are successes that are going to pop up. Somewhere along the line, somebody's going to have a good success where they built a trailer and they put it up on Indiegogo or Kickstarter. And the next thing you know, they end up getting it funded, and they turn around and try to fund a small feature out of that, and they become successful. So until we reach that mark, until there's a big enough milestone, if you will, where everybody can look and start talking to these people and say, hey, how did you get to that point? What were the steps that you took? Then we're not going to see much success other than just the smaller victories for filmmakers that raise the couple of thousand dollars for their projects. So what's all this talk about these SEC rules and proposed rulemaking and the Jumpstart Our Business Jobs Act, Stan? Thanks for asking, Stan. Here's the thing. It looks like the entire movement for this crowdfunding and crowdsourcing, the pressure that Congress is trying to put on the business economy to create jobs, is going to help out filmmakers. It's just it will be a matter of time on how successful it becomes, or if anything transpires and nothing changes, that you're just going to continue with Kickstarter and Indiegogo campaigns and raise the micro budgets, if you will, the smaller amounts. And only time will tell, so we'll see. I really hope this turns into something worthwhile, because I'd really love to see someone become a success and make this new Jobs Act and the crowdfunding, crowdsourcing concept really work out. In one conversation I had with a filmmaker, we talked about that, let's say, for instance, you already had your project completed. Maybe you did crowdfunding and crowdsourcing for promotion and marketing of your film. Let's say, for instance, you put together a campaign for $5,000, and the campaign was, hey, the film is already made, we have it here, but if you buy a DVD for 10 bucks, or you make a donation for, say, 25 bucks, let's put it that way, and you'll get a DVD and a t-shirt or a mug or a wristband or, you know, whatever swag that you're going to send out, and you end up being able to get your film marketed and promoted, or maybe even four-walled and taking it from city to city. So there's another opportunity of thinking not only from trying to get funding to get your trailer done, but let's say, for instance, you already have your trailer done, maybe the short or the web series you're doing or the feature you've completed. Maybe putting together a campaign to help out with your marketing and advertising will help out, because that will allow you to go from, you know, to the film festivals and enter the film festivals and pay the festival fees from 50 bucks, 25 bucks to a couple hundred or whatever it happens to be, depending on the festival, plus the dubbing and duplication charges that you will have to pay to enter those festivals. And a lot of time, people don't think about that. Filmmakers don't think about, I say a lot of time, a vast majority of time, They don't think about it until the project is completed and say, now we have to enter it in all these film festivals, but I figured out that if I'm going to enter these 10 or 15 festivals, it's going to cost me at least $3,000, and we've already spent all the money. There could be campaigns for those marketing adventures. So we'll see. So in short, do your Kickstarter campaign, do your Indiegogo campaign, and if you've got good success, send me an email to podcast@thehollywoodsouthblog.com, and let's take a look at it. One of the other aspects of working in the indie film scene is that you may at one point or another want to collaborate on a script. Let's say you're an actor and you know somebody who's a writer, but you have an idea and you want to sit down and collaborate on writing a script. Or let's say you're the director and somebody wants to be the producer. You name the combination, but you want to collaborate on the script. I'm going to make this simple. I'm going to keep it as two people collaborating on a script. First things first, you're going to draw up an agreement. You're going to have an agreement put together so that once you get the script written, it specifically delineates who did what the split as far as who owns the copyright in that script. It especially has to be enumerated into the contract, because I've seen numerous stories and lawsuits, and it will continue to happen day after day after day, where somebody gets together and let's say they're the want to be the director and they have an idea for something, and there's somebody who's a screenwriter or they're an aspiring screenwriter and they want to put together a good script on some good ideas. So the director sits down with them, they come up with all these ideas, and the writer goes out and turns around and produces a script. There's some kind of squabble, one person gets their nose bent out of shape, and the next thing you know is that somehow or another that script gets sold or picked up, and the director comes back and says, I own half that script because it was my ideas. And the writer's going to say, no, but you may have those ideas, but ideas aren't copyrightable, and I put them down into words, into a script, so I own 100% of the script. Here's the thing. The more I started thinking about this part of the indie film scene, as I like to call it, I realized that I've collected over the years numerous contracts and agreements and forms and things that I use in my, day-to-day business or when I'm putting together agreements. And there are contracts that have been built over the years that I've used for one of them here, collaboration on a script, that I have found have worked perfectly well for me. So I figured I could end up reading the entire contract, which would put everybody to sleep, because if you're doing something else and you're listening to this casually, you think, I'm just going to go to the show notes and download the thing. And then I realized, well, what I need to do is hit the broad strokes. And the broad strokes are, on this example, collaboration on a script, whatever the two parties are, you've got to be able to delineate what you're going to do, what each party is responsible for the script, being able to produce it, because you now have intellectual property, a copyright is created in the script, and who owns what of the script. Generally speaking, I put it at 50-50. Using the example I had before where the director had the idea and the screenwriter wrote it, well, the screenwriter has to go back to the director, and the director reads it and says, no, what about this? And then they collaborate on ideas of how to change scenes and change dialogue and things like that. Now, if you set out right from the beginning and say, well, I'm going to be the director, you be the screenwriter, I want 25% of this, and you can have 75% of this, then fine, fair enough. Go ahead and do it that way. I start off with 50-50 because you've got two people. I'll leave it up to you individual parties to decide how you want to divvy up the pie. A vast majority of them never lead to anything, but you never know. 10, 15 years down the road, you may get into a situation where all of a sudden somebody likes the script and it gets optioned, or it possibly gets turned into a film, if you will. And the script is purchased and the writers are compensated. What will happen is the production company, the entity, the studio, whoever's going to purchase that script is going to turn around and cut a check. And that check is going to be written to whatever entity that the two of you collaborators had decided is going to be the entity that accepts that payment. Because they don't want to get into a squabble of, listen, you guys divvy it up. You had your own contract and your own ideas. Here's the check. You divvy it up whatever way you want. We don't want to hassle with it. And what will eventually happen is somebody gets their nose bent out of place, the director or the writer. And I'm not picking on directors and writers. I'm just using that as an example. But somebody will say, no, I should get half. you know, because it was my ideas, or I should get half because I wrote it, or I should get more because I wrote it. You have to be able to delineate these things in a contract from the very beginning. I find probably 95% of the time when somebody asks me a question, well, you know, I sat down with a guy who was a director and he had some ideas and I said, wow, I want to write a script about that because this person wanted to write a feature script. Maybe it's their first one, maybe it's their 10th one, and they want to work with somebody new and they really like this director and they think it may, you know, they may be doing something with them, that they sit down and try to put something together on paper. All of a sudden the script is made and somebody says something and, you know, a year goes by or, you know, a week goes by and the person says, well, I don't want to work with you anymore. You get in an argument. It happens all the time. For whatever reason it happens to be, now all of a sudden people are going to start bunkering down and, you know, digging a hole in the ground and, you know, getting ready for war because the director's going to argue, I own the script, not you. It was my idea. And the screenwriter's going to say, no, you can't copyright it. An idea, you have to put it in a tangible form of the screenplay and blah, 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 back and forth, back and forth. I would say 95% of the time I'm asked these kinds of questions, the first thing I say is, well, what did the contract say? And then they just look at you and their eyes pancake and they stare at you. And then I say, you didn't have a contract? And they said, well, no, it started off at first, we were friends and it worked out well for 6 months and the next thing you know is it all went south and it is that, and there's nothing you can do at that point other than you got to sit down with the other side and write a contract and determine who owns what at that point, because you'll end up in court and nobody makes any money except the attorneys involved fighting it out. So what have you done? You've gone down a road for absolutely nothing. Collaboration on a script, the parties involved, I use an example as two parties, you've got to have a contract put together. And that whole idea that I started thinking about led me to another solution. Like I said, I wanted to help out as best I could in the indie film scene because I've always been taught in my career to try to help other people out in their career as they're moving up. And that is I will have to say, and I'm not asking for a pat on the back, I have to say it's a very narrow feeling in this industry, because literally in this industry, it's step on the guy's hands on the rung below you on the ladder and smash them as much as you can because I've got mine and, you know, I don't want them getting it. That's the pervasive attitude. However, I've always been taught to try to help out and pass along those skills and abilities to other people. I learned that more working from behind the camera and learning that craft and cinematography. And the whole idea behind it was is that if nobody ever did that, the art would die. Now, technically speaking, the art's not going to die. If you look at it as more of a philanthropical kind of thing, then continuing the art and continuing this process of helping other people, you know, it's just goodwill. It's just good karma is the way I see it. The more I thought about it, I thought, what if I took all this paperwork and forms and everything that I had and made them available for download on the website? And I thought about that, and then I realized that as I started stacking them together of the thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars over the years that I have paid other people, lawyers, to craft these contracts for me. They know that they're going to craft a contract for you, and once it's crafted, then the next project you're going to go on to, you're just going to change the names in the contract, and somebody else is going to sign it, because that's going to work out pretty well. That's generally the way it works. So you may spend $2,500, $5,000 for a contract to be drafted. In this instance, a collaboration on a script, you're going to be able to use that in the future. I'm toying around with the idea of putting up some kind of PayPal system on the website where you can go there, take a look at a contract, and let's say you want to get a script collaboration contract, and you look at it, and I can't remember how, let's say it's 15 pages, and you look at the front page, and it says, okay, this is between party A and party B, and party A is the director, and party B is the writer. And then you realize, okay, well, if I buy the contract, put my names in it and fill it out, I've got a contract that I can use for this script that we're collaborating on, and I don't have to worry about in the future. I'm not saying you don't have to worry about the future, but at least you started off and the party started off with a contractual basis. Once you get that out of the way, listen, if you're friends or you become friends and things work out well, that contract is just a piece of paper. It really doesn't mean anything other than, let's say the two, this director and this fictional screenwriter, become successful. Then they go, man, it was so great working on that project, and we split it 50-50 or 75-25 or whatever numbers you decide to come up with. In the future, it will become, let's say, good karma for you. That's about the only thing I can, you know, come up with. Give me some ideas. Send me some emails, podcast@thehollywoodsouthblog.com, and let me know if you're interested. Because if not, I won't put the time and effort into putting up the system, because I would have to be able to put up a pay system so that you can go there, take a look at the document and be able to download it and pay for the document. And listen, I'm not talking about thousands of dollars for these contracts. I'm talking about just enough to be able to pay for the, like we talked about, the Indiegogo and the Kickstarter campaigns, to pay all the middleman that, you know, and PayPal takes their little bit, just to be able to support that system. So if it becomes something that, a tool that you use as an independent filmmaker, hey, great. So I was trying to figure out how to solve this problem and help other filmmakers out. And I figured that, well, maybe I'll try this and see how it works. But there's a lot of work and effort that will be involved in trying to do that. If you're interested, shoot me an email and let's see how it goes. If it works out, then if you're a new filmmaker and let's say you're that director and you want a contract that you can sign with a screenwriter, then it'll be worthwhile, because nothing's going to come free in your career if you're not going to be able to put money and time and effort into it. Going back to one of the listener emails that talked about acting, if you're going to be an actor in the industry, you're going to put money into your headshots, into your wardrobe, into your resumes, into your demo reels, things like that. So the NOLA Film Festival is over. I hope everybody had an opportunity to go see it. I hope you had an opportunity to see the NOLA Bound documentary, which I was a very lucky member, one of the 27 participants. The premiere was over at the Joy Theater. And if you didn't see it, then go to the website, and there's a banner on the website. Go to thehollywoodsouthblog.com, click on the banner, and guess what? You can watch it for free. Now, it was free screening anyway, but it's cool to go to the theater and hang out with your friends and watch a movie, right? It's about, I don't know, 52, 53 minutes long, and it's a documentary called NOLA Bound. So check it out. Go to the website, click on the banner, and there you go. So my book recommendation is The Public Domain, How to Find and Use Copyright-Free Writings, Music, Art, and More by Stephen Fishman of NOLA Press. It's about $14 or less. NOLA Press, a great publisher. They publish a lot of law books. And this is a great little book to have on your desk, because this public domain question gets asked a tremendous amount of time in the documentary world. Now, there's two schools of thoughts on public domain. In the documentary world, I essentially run across filmmakers who just feel like they're entitled to everything and they can claim public domain on anything and everything because they're documentary filmmakers and nobody is going to tell us not to use this material. And then they have people who say, well, is this in public domain? Is it not in public domain? How do I figure this out? This little book, it's great. The public domain. You'll be able to find out what is public domain, dealing with public domain gray areas, because there are gray areas, what copyrights protect, what's the difference between music and sound recordings, what's a sync license, what's a mechanical, mechanical sync license, you lost me, Stan. Don't worry, the book will figure this out for you. Copyrights restored from public domain. Yes, there are copyrights who fell into the public domain that got restored. That's interesting. Art, photography, movie, television, computer software, architecture, maps, choreography. I didn't even know anything about the choreography part until I read the book. Those are the topics that they talk about for public domain. This is an absolute must-have on your shelf. It's about $14 or less. I'll have the link on the website. Software recommendation, OhmWriter. It's exactly how it sounds. OhmWriter. OhmWriter. W-R-I-T-E-R. And the best thing about it is it's free. I love this little gadget. There's a pay version of about $4 or $5, if I remember correctly, which provides a few other musical tracks. But here's the cool part of it. If I launch my Ohm Rider, it doesn't matter whether I've got my Outlook open and three other applications open. Ohm Rider takes over the entire computer screen, and the only thing that it has is this really nice, serene backdrop. There's some musical loops that you can play, but to me, it's a little bit too torturous because it's the same loop over and over. This is what I do. I have Spotify, free version, and I select tracks in Spotify. Sometimes it's soundtracks, sometimes it's classical, sometimes it's soundtracks that I've worked on that bring back specific memories. And I'll play the music in the background very low, and I'll launch Ohm Rider. And all Ohm Rider is just simply sort of a text program, but it eliminates everything else off your screen. You know, the Facebook notifications and the pop-ups and the dings and the dongs and all that that people are trying to instant message you, which you just for some reason refuse to turn off your instant messaging when you're writing. And you can sit there and write, and it's just sort of a serene thing. Ohm Rider. And it's free. Check it out, ohmrider.com. I'm telling you, it's a free little app. It's great. It's really, really a nice little application. Free crew listings at the website, as usual, as I talked about in the beginning with listener email. You can go there if you want to get on a grip crew, electrical crew. Fill it out. It's free. Free crew listings. And list yourself as many departments as you want to. Now, you know, don't say you're a hairstylist when you're not a hairstylist, or don't say you're a makeup artist when you're not a makeup artist. Apply for the positions that you feel as though that you can fulfill. They're free. The Hollywood South Blacklist group sign up. Go there and click on the link and sign up. It's sort of an industry inside group where you can post questions, and it's free. Go figure. The Hollywood South blog Facebook page, go there on Facebook, of course, and click like. Why? Because we all like likes, right? And be sure to send me your listener emails. So hit me up on what you think about the crowdsourcing, Kickstarter, Indiegogo campaigns, if you're running a campaign and it was successful or even not successful. Give us your experiences because you'll maybe help somebody else out. Look into the articles that I will post up in the show notes. Take a look at the book that I had recommended, especially Ohm Rider, the software, which is free. And keep sending those emails because I read every single one of them. They may not make it on the podcast, but I try to answer everyone's question to the best of my abilities. And guess what? It's all for free. Well, everybody, thanks for joining me on the Hollywood South Blacklist, where we tried to discuss all things Hollywood South, a filmmaker's paradise. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, send us an email to podcast@thehollywoodsouthblog.com. And be sure to stop by the website to take a look around. We'll have all the links to the show notes and everything I discussed on the show. This is Stan Gill for the Hollywood South Blacklist. Thanks for listening.